everybody is here. It looks like this it looks like you have the whole village. This is Matt Brown, and he started out as our IC for the Wolverine Creek Fire. And then you've moved to our liaison, and every day, Matt, you've probably seen him around the village, comes up and gives us the latest on what's going on with the fire. Then we found out that he also has a terrific degree in fire ecology and actually farming.
Fire ecology and fire management. So, what fire ecology and wildland fire management?
And where did I get farming?
I don't know. I guess.
then I just made up the rest of his resume. But we asked him to come and talk today about fire ecology and fire behavior to try to get a little more understanding about what's going on at the end of our road. So, Matt.
Yeah, thank you for the introduction.
Trying not to spill my water here.
So, thank you. I appreciate the audience. That's cool. It was a perfect opportunity to talk about this, and so now we have a current fire situation here. And, it's interesting because I think more about, the ecology side of things in my job and when we're humans, it's kind of like, it's an inconvenience for sure, and it seems like we get these fires that burn real hot and it's really disappointing that it is, in the span of a human lifetime is just like a glimpse in the big grand scheme of things. So, I think it's important for everybody to understand, where we're at, in this time in history and what's going on with our fire here and just how the ecosystem, the processes that happen. I think it'd be a good opportunity to explain that to some folks. And there's probably some people in here that are probably a lot smarter than me, maybe probably better educated, but it's just a perfect opportunity to talk about it, right? So again, just appreciate the opportunity to do so. My education is in fire ecology and fire management, not so much into education, so I'm not the best public speaker, but I'll get through this together. So just to lead off, I thought this was a good explanation, in the United States on fire regimes. So fire regimes in general is basically the frequency and intensity of fires and how they burn in our ecosystems here, in our forested areas. A good map here, won't spend too much time about over in the eastern United States, but more so, we're obviously going to concentrate up here, and where we're at in the Washington area. A little background, I've been in the business for 17 years with the Forest Service, all in fire. I spent most of my career here in Arizona. In Arizona, we have the largest ponderosa pine forest stringer that runs across the northern part of the state. The Coconino National Forest is up in here at Flagstaff, Arizona, where I was raised and worked for a majority of that 17 years is in that neck of the woods. So, in that ecosystem, we're used to a lot of fire. It's a high-frequency, low-intensity, historical fire regime. So in addition to our regular lightning and human-caused fires, which there are a lot of, we also do a lot of prescribed burning on the shoulder seasons, the spring and the fall. When the whole point of the prescribed fire stuff is to mimic natural fire to keep those regimes within those age areas. When you start getting out of whack, through the last almost 100 years, maybe more, of fire suppression, we've let our forest in general build up to unhealthy levels. And that results, we see a lot of stuff play out in today's fires, the large intensities, the very active fire behavior that you guys see on the news is kind of a direct result of the, hate to do this, but I'm going to throw Smokey the Bear under the bus here. So Smokey the Bear has a message. We don't want unnecessary fires resulting from human stuff, right? But in the natural world, lightning causes fires, you know, that's what they do. They're supposed to, you know, help maintain, clean up the forested areas. And when we get out of whack again, we get these uncontrollable and high severity fires that are altogether not really good for the ecosystem. You have damage to soils, you have damage to the wildlife, you have damage to the ecosystem in general as a whole in high severity fires. Well, to shift the focus here, where I'm used to fire history, but to up here, and you still see the different shades there in with the map here, you know. You're looking at, in this neck of the woods, we're looking at this lighter shade of purple or darker shade. So basically that 200 to 500 years, what that's telling you is that stand replacement fires occur every 200 to 500 years. That's in what we call the mixed conifer stands. Your Douglas firs, your spruces, your ponderosa pine, when all that stuff is mixed, at these higher elevations you get what's called the mixed conifer vegetation type.
So does stand replacement mean that the whole stand gets burned down?
Yep, exactly. So to put that into a little bit of perspective, you know, that doesn't occur every time a fire starts in that vegetation type, but that is what it's designed to do. You know, what you'll get in some cases in wetter climates, which Washington generally is a wetter climate, is you get these, and I don't have a good picture to show, but you'll get like clumps that burn completely down, and you get this mosaic pattern throughout a landscape. And that's generally a healthy thing. You know, a lot of the times when our high fire dangers align with generally within a month or two of our rainy seasons. You know, so those rainy seasons will come in and help squash those fires, but during the meantime, you're getting these little pockets, and I'm talking more on a macro scale, not a micro scale, over the landscape of these patches of forest burn. In this vegetation, they burn completely down, and they open up, and then there'll be grasslands in between these stands. And that's probably how it should look. However, you know, in the current conditions, what we're facing over here in Wolverine Creek, what you have is a pretty well intact stand. And if the rest of the lake wasn't burned off, you know, it wouldn't be such a unique place or a unique situation. But you know, riding the boat up and down, you know, you guys all can see or appreciate what the change in vegetation is. But it's also a history lesson as well. This vegetation structure here, 200 to 500 years, it builds up to what we call climax, forest climax condition. And I think maybe that succession slide would be a good one to move on to. So it's a very, very basic diagram, but it gives a good depiction of how this works. So, in ecology, ecological succession, what you start from at some point is basically bare soil. From bare soil, you get your little plants, your brushes, your grasses, and from brushes, and then you go into your smaller trees, your sun-tolerant trees, and then as that succeeds over time, you get your shade-intolerant trees, and then you get your shade-tolerant trees as your climax vegetation condition. In a climax condition, which we have out there on the side of the hill, that's just it. Your climax gets reached, and there has to be a disturbance then for the ecological process to repeat itself. In most cases, in the western United States, it's fire. But left without fire, you then have other disturbances in there that can be act as the same disturbance. For example, insects, bark beetles, worms, you know, other kinds of insect infestations that will, at some point, act as that disturbance to start that cycle again. So, what I see, you know, again, on the side of the hill here, off the lake shore, is a climax condition. We got fire in there. We have abnormal temperatures, below normal precipitation. Regardless if that's a historical or out of whack condition, it is what it is. Typically speaking, that's when you'll get the stand replacing fires. One of the points I'm trying to bring out is it's kind of scary because where we're at, right? You know, and at the same time, though, it is a process that if it's not going to occur now, it will occur in probably the near future. Just a matter of time. And over the history of fire suppression, probably, you know, we've let these things go and put them off for so long, but it's nature, and it's going to do what it does at some point. We're just here witnessing a small portion of it at this moment in time. So what happens after it all burns down? You know, we'll if it burns all the way down over here, and it may not, but if it does, and I'll show you another map and talk to you about the fire itself, but if it burns down, you know, I think the important thing to remember is that we are just witnesses to these natural processes. It'll never look the same as it does. You know, it's going to go turn back into what you see across the other side of the lake, that grass and some few trees start still growing, and then that process is starting to repeat. If we can go into the...
Yeah, this one there.
Thank you. So, to go into the current situation with the Wolverine Fire... So here is our, and I'll explain some of these lines, but that's our current topography and vegetation out there on the fire. It started, let me get my orientation, Lightning Ridge, Lightning Creek, and we got Wolverine Creek here. So it started up high, and where it's burning is kind of up and over in this little ridge right here right now. It's got fire established in the lower slopes here, a little bit back over on the other side of Riddle Creek. But when you look at this...
Is north up on this?
North is up, yes. So this is south, north, west, and east.
No, it's right now.
Something's wrong.
What do you got?
The lake's out.
Lake's over there.
Lake's over here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, reference.
Okay.
Oh, you said
reference.
That helps.
The new start is in there.
Yeah.
Everybody oriented?
Yeah.
8301 Road?
Yes.
Railroad Creek? So, what you see here is why this thing hasn't really picked up and charged yet is all this broken, rocky country, right? There's just a little few bands of trees in here. I'll take you back to the start of the fire. So the start of the fire, we put in three of our repellers. They cut a hell spot up here on this ridge, walked down the fire. They were only able to access the upper portion of it. There was the upper portion, and then there was another. It might have been a whole new lightning strike altogether. It looked like it was a long distance off, but it could have just been rollout from the main fire too. Either way, there was two sections of fire. We were able to access the upper portion, and we were able to put a little bit of line around it on this upper slope area. But the problem was everything downslope. The access to particularly the lower slope piece of fire and the underslope of the main fire was just, it just really wasn't accessible. In a safe way. There was a lot of exposure to put those guys out there, or put people out there, and to deal with that situation. So, and along this whole section of topography here, as far as we can tell, you know, flying it with the helicopter, low and slow, looking at stuff, there's just not really a very good place to pin this fire down where it's at. So strategy-wise, we're looking at this and we're saying, okay, well, it's not safe, you know, to put people in there. So we go back to where we know we have a workable situation. So we can play this out a little bit and say, well, we got aircraft, and we did. We used aircraft in the first 2 days of this fire. The problem with aircraft is with the water is you got to have people on the ground to work with that water. Punch your fire lines in to, you know, and without that, that water's not going to put it out, at least not this time of year. Things are dry. That being said, to keep putting water on it was just, it wasn't going to clear it out. It was just going to cost more money. You have exposure to your pilots. So it just wasn't a very, talk about risk management, it just wasn't a very good plan. On the other end of that, you know, again with the aircraft stuff, if that was our only plan to use aircraft, well, it wasn't a very good plan, because outside of what this little fire is doing in the state, Canada, Alaska, and the rest of the country, there's other larger fires going on. So we talk about that, and there's only a limited amount of firefighting resources, especially with the aircraft, your air tankers, your heavy helicopters, your hotshot crews. When there's bigger fires that are threatening homes and are bigger, you know, when we go to ask or to hold on to resources, it's tough to have your aircraft as the only resource. Is not a very good plan, because we don't know if we're going to have it one day or not. When something bigger or badder breaks, that aircraft goes away, then you start with that. So, again, the best plan that we came up with strategy-wise is to come back to the 8301 road. We're prepping it, taking some of the vegetation out along the edges there, so that if the fire comes, you know, we're going to have to do some sort of back burn firing operation here. So let's go back to the original area here with the Wolverine fire, current condition, and tie that back into kind of what I'm talking about with climax conditions and vegetation structure. So that fire, when it backs off here and finds this field path, and it will, the main concern is this. The main concern is this picking up through here and running right into the Lucerne, because there's nothing to stop it vegetation-wise. You lose your natural barriers. It's got free roam to range here. So right now, it's buying us a lot of time, keeping it hung up in this neck of the woods here. So this yellow line right here, so we set up these what we call management action points. So that means when a fire gets to a certain location, we are going to respond by doing X. And this line here, this symbolizes a management action point of that's going to trigger us to maybe do some little bit of firing operations in here to try to keep this from running up these slopes. Keep it from running up the slopes by fighting fire to fire. We put fire kind of on the ridge top here and let it back down, and it'll back down both sides, but it'll back down in low intensities. And that helps so that it doesn't completely do a crown fire and slick off the hills. We're trying to retain some of the vegetation in there. So that's one of our objectives. And it also is twofold. It helps the fire from not just racing across here. Surface fire aside, I mean, the fire's edge. The way fire behavior works in this particular field type is it propagates through spotting, not necessarily through surface fire. Propagates through spotting, and it propagates through rolling downhill with the topography. That's how it keeps itself alive. It's how it sustains itself. Spotting is caused by a single tree torch or a group torch or, you know, small crown runs. That's what you see if you're out there at night and you see a tree go up. That would be a single tree torch. You see a bunch of trees go up at once. That's a group torch. And all that stuff is throwing hot embers in every direction, whichever way the wind flows. Some other challenges we have with this type of field structure or vegetation structure is it's extremely thick. If you were to walk through there, you know, you may not be able to walk through some of that area. The duff layers are probably as deep as what the height is of a campfire ring here, you know, at 3 foot deep level. to get, you know, it took 2 days for three people to knock in, you know, roughly 100 feet of fire line when they initially attacked this thing, to get down to that bare mineral soil that you need to stop the surface fire. So, again, the thought process.
And the darker, the denser, is that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a good way. Yep, exactly. So the darker the green, the more dense it is. So this whole lightning ridge is very, very dense. A little bit more open here, and maybe not quite as dense, but still quite a bit of fuel.
So it will burn unless you can cut a large swath in it, or even then it'll still burn.
So the thought process here is that we probably can't do anything to keep it from not burning at this point. Outside of a wet weather event, taking consideration where we're at, time of season, right? We really, this is kind of an early fire, number one. We still have, what, two and a half, maybe 3 months of worse conditions coming ahead. So, when we talk about these things operationally, we talk about, okay, so say we try to go after it right now with our hot shot crews, with our helicopter that we have right now. And so say we go after that, but we got to think. Now, first of all, where do we insert these people at? Are we hiking them up from down to up? I mean, that itself is a huge feat. You're talking about four crews, that's 80 people. It's 80 people you're exposing to countless numbers of medical issues and injury. You know, what do you do if it's a life-threatening injury? Maybe you'll get somebody out by helicopter through a short haul type of deal, but is that a good plan?
Or how would you feed them?
And so that's going into logistics. So we carry MREs. I mean, we can bring helicopters in, do sling loads, and drop it there. You know, but how long are you going to do that for? And then, you know, then you're talking about more exposure on the aircraft side. Talking about exposing, you know, aircraft doesn't, I mean, they're very unforgiving accidents with aircraft. It's not like a vehicle where you get in a head-on collision and you might survive, you know. With aircraft, there's pretty much no survivors when that happens. So we're really trying to take everything into consideration, and even your guys' safety and your guys' well-being. Life, property, resources, that's our tier of how we go about doing business. And life includes you guys. Life includes our firefighters. We have to consider that as a number one priority.
And with the distances and steepness involved in here, there's no way that they could use their escape routes to safety zones in a short period of time if you get a fire that stands up and decides to run.
So that's another good point there. I mean, there's no risk management-wise. There's not really a good option to march people up the hill and go after the city. So I just want to put that out there first and foremost, because that is, you know, we do consider those things as first options. We are by no means in a let it burn mentality, but because of the limited options we have here, there's really nothing we can do to stop it from munching away. So again, we took the time to try to get ahead of this by putting our crews in here where we have a good working area, where we have access to our medical stuff, and we have a logistical operation to work on to sustain our operations. So back to the management action points. So in this scenario here, we get fire established here. We will ignite using aerial ignitions to keep it from running up the slope. What happens in fire behavior if it runs up the slope, and with the historical weather patterns of down lake winds that can loft unchecked spots into places that we're not ready for? So we use fire to kind of mellow that out. Timing is going to be important in this. If we implement our ignitions, we would probably do it in the later portions of the evenings where we're...
When that is over in operation,
we're in the later portions of the afternoon and early portions of the evening, you get a higher relative humidity, moisture in the air, less chance of spotting, less chance of active fire debris.
You're not currently doing that.
No, we're not. Our second management action plan, and this is our first, very first map, so there's another map out there that shows a different line in here, but it's the same thought process. So second line of management action point is if fire gets established in Lightning Creek itself. And eventually it's going to get here to Lightning Creek, somewhere along here, at some point. We don't know if it's going to come in from the top. Most likely scenario is it's going to catch field path here and go with the field around the bottom. It'll take a lot of time for this to roll down and catch, and then something, you know, this would be the longer duration scenario. This is probably the most likely and most immediate path that it's going to take to Lightning Creek and Lightning Ridge. So when we do get fire in Lightning Creek, and we know that it's established, and we know that it's going to try to get active up on Lightning Ridge here, the next course of action and the level 3 evacuation trigger is this. Essentially, if we know it's going to get on Lightning Ridge, you know, that's when we're probably not going to wait until it actually gets onto the ridge itself. That's probably a little bit too late. I'm trying to give a little bit of heads up, advance notice, 24 or 48 hours, when we know this is going to happen, that's when that level 3 is going to get triggered. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, but the other course of action is what's going to happen is we again would pick up a backfire operation along the ridge top and try to keep that fire from running up.
And backfiring onto the Lightning Ridge side.
Correct. Correct. So same.
It's searching.
Aren't we all searching? It does this a lot.
This is a theological moment.
So the reason why we're choosing these ridge tops is that fire is not like water, and it goes downwards with less intensity and slower than it would going up here.
Okay.
So by doing that on the ridge tops, it propagates a lower or moderate versus a severe or intense fire behavior. If fire is on the bottom of the slope, it'll run to the top very quick. A lot of intensity, a lot of fire behavior, bad results ecologically. So by doing this off the ridge tops, it's a little bit more mellow, more easily, and it's a chance to control it. And so that's why we take ridge tops with that kind of backfire to start from it. So again, if fire gets over here or over here, we start a firing operation so that fire backs into the active portion, mellows it out, versus letting it rush from the bottom up. And again, with the winds kicking up, that'll take that. These things can spot, you know, it probably wouldn't be uncommon half a mile away.
Really?
With good winds and a big push.
Where is Martin Ridge?
At which ridge?
Martin
Ridge. It's
out here.
So there's some mountains here. And again, so reference, this is about mile marker 4 and 4.5-ish or so.
Oh.
So you got another 5 miles to the village and my operation here.
It's not really threatening the village, it's just threatening
your escape route. So that's the concern. That's why we want to be able to mellow this out to give time for these things to happen. So this isn't immediately threatening the village or the mine. I guess in a far off situation it could threaten the village directly, but it'd take a lot of things to happen. Probably still a possibility, but that's not the immediate threat.
you never know when there's thunderstorms rolling through, you never know what something else is going to happen.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, there's all kinds of what ifs out there, but anyway, so this is what we're dealing with at hand. In conjunction with this firing operation, you know, we would also have our crews on the road. They would actually walk up to some of this country, mid-slope or so, put their own fire down to help it buffer this stuff out. And along the road, we try to do the same thing, keep it a low-intensity fire to retain aesthetics and not to cause any kind of soil issues. When things burn really hot, you get what's called a hydrophobic soil. It doesn't hold water. Water just slicks right off of it. And when water slicks right off of it during heavy rains, you get all kinds of erosion issues. Rocks, trees get washed right off the hill, causing more problems for the road, for the access, and longer-term effects. Any questions so far? Clarification on anything?
So if you back burn from the road, would you actually start at the road and let it run up, or would you start above the road and let it run down?
Exactly. So I said we put people on foot up into these mid-slope areas and put fire down. As our fire would be backing off this ridge down this way,
yeah.
We'd also have people in here put a little bit of fire down mid-slope so that it also mellows out the intensity and let it back down to the road.
So the road becomes a fire break.
It does, yeah. The road is our control. It is our control feature.
Okay.
Now, that topography is really steep, so there's an element of risk to the firefighters doing that burn operation.
Absolutely. So what makes a difference is, number one, we have a physician's assistant. We have a EMT, paramedic. We actually have reasonable response for medical issues along this road between Lucerne and Holt. We also have the a quick, you know, evacuation helispot medevac down there at the point of Lucerne by the cap or by the Forest Service guard station. We also have boats, and we also have the helispots here at the mine to use. All those things in combination, I mean, that's the best suit for our firefighters to operate.
Can you talk speed of the fire, like coming up from that valley up the ridge?
Here?
Yeah, like when you say mellow versus fast.
Low severity or high intensity versus low intensity?
Time-wise, what is there like an approximate, like 2 hours?
Again, it'll just depend on the weather conditions. I'll put it, the best way I can explain it is, because I can tell you something, but I don't think that would be accurate. What I'll tell you is that under ideal weather conditions for us to burn with good results, you know, you won't see this really, this might take a day or two for it to burn together. With bad weather, meaning hot, dry, windy days. I'll give you an example over here on the Rex fire, I believe it was, right across the lake. Well, that burned within about a 15-hour period, and basically, I don't know, 10,000 acres or so.
Wow.
With one storm. So there is, so it's unpredictable, really, but we would like to take advantage of any kind of weather conditions to stop that from happening versus being forced to do it. We'd like to do it on our own terms instead of being forced. Ideally. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
Going back to your first slide, where you're talking about the different fire regimes across the country. How is that determined? You have, you know, like 200 to 250 year span when a stand typically burns.
Has it come up with that?
Yeah. How do you determine that?
Dendrochronology. It's a very focused part of fire ecology science, where they study tree rings, old growth tree rings, and within the tree rings itself, you can tell when a fire happened within that lifespan of that tree. There's a guy, Professor Swetnam out of the University of Arizona, is probably the world's leading expert on this thing. So a lot of this information comes from his shop down there. It's been researched for probably, I don't know, 50, 50 good years or so, and there's a lot of consistent science that bases off. Obviously, it's 200 to 500 years, so I think it varies because of temperate climates. In the southwest, intermixed conifer forest, you probably get it every 200 years, versus, say, up in here in the Pacific Northwest when there's more moisture. Make sense?
Yeah.
It's coming down.
Yeah.
Matt.
In predicting that, is primarily the prevailing winds that give you your predictions of the way it's going to move?
Aligned with the field path.
A lot, okay.
Fire history in the
up
area.
The downhill versus the uphill.
So you got two different things. In a day without wind, fire's going to want to go slow.
Okay.
But here along the lake, and fire history tells us this throughout the last 30, 40 years, you get that down lake effect. And that, you know, it's pretty much the cooling from the Cascades that push it downlink. Okay, and along with that, it brings those winds that wants to drag fire in that direction.
And that's why, even though it's dark behind it, not much chance it's going to go that way. Sparse area it's in now.
There is a little bit of fire up there in Riddle Creek. So, I mean, it depends on what the field conditions are. I mean, fire's going to go where there's burnable material.
Okay.
Outside of wind. Wind's going to drive it, slope's going to drive it, but without the winds pushing it one way or another, it's going to find the field path and the slope. When those things align, it's going to go that direction.
So what's the green line there on the left?
The green line was our first management.
No, the one down there, got it.
Yeah, good question. So we have to put a box around this thing, right? So we have this road as a control feature.
Okay.
To the north, we kind of have some wilderness, and the national park is limiting their land for our fire to go reside in, maybe. It's a joke. We'll strike that from the record. our primary concern is this right here. What happens out here is not necessarily a focus for us. It is a concern, but not a focus.
Is it another line where your hand lines cut in?
Exactly. So this is our western boundary, our western control feature. Basically, we're taking advantage of broken country. And that line may not be completely accurate, it just made sense on a map. I think it's more up this area here.
It is going up the ridge.
What, this?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So we're looking at something a little bit more shorter. What you have along these ridge tops is not much fuel. The only way it's going to get across there is if it spots through some large event. We're not going to actually have hand line up here because we're using the natural features there. And combination, so something up this ridge here from the road, there's a little bit of actual hand line that was dug, ties into these big rock features, and then we just leapfrog vegetation to vegetation until we have something that resembles a control feature to stop any kind of surface fire spread. You still have spotting concerns no matter which way you look at it. It's going to be spotting concerns past our control.
But with the wind pushing down lake, that it shouldn't go that direction, per se.
Exactly. So prevailing winds don't necessarily want to go up canyon.
Right.
Wow.
So if the road went through, you wouldn't even care about us right now, probably.
No, there would still be.
I mean, if we had another exit, anything negative. I mean, if our only way out goes through your box. In some ways, that makes us more of a concern.
Absolutely.
Immediate to you that if there was another exit, that's all.
Because there is a secondary concern of maybe something de-establishing and coming up and threatening the village.
Right, right.
So all this is just trying. It's pre-planning. It's trying to get ahead of this thing. Trying to keep it on our terms. Right. So this is the best plan we can do to minimize the event of that it does threaten you guys and the mine's operations. Say if you took out Holden Mine, you took out Holden Village, and there was no infrastructure here, we wouldn't be even this aggressive. We would try to manage it more for an ecological standpoint, but that can mean a lot of things. We would still probably have an aerial ignition type of situation where we would try to keep low severity to moderate fire intensity in those areas. What we don't want, just strictly from a forest ecology standpoint, we don't want this new belt. There's a reason for that. This is what's called LSR, late successional reserve. So these are areas that are identified as unique pieces of vegetation found within the Okanagan Wenatchee National Forest that are actually managed for habitat for endangered species and for its unique vegetation structure. It's called late successional because it's that old. It's that climax period, and you just don't see a lot of it. It's disappearing because it's burning down, or disease, or insects are tearing it apart. So again, just in the time frame of ecology, it's just that time period for these climax conditions to disturbances to happen across the landscape. We just so happen to be here during this time.
How much rain inches do you need to suppress that? You probably can't put it out this time of year.
And that's just it. So, I mean, if we had 3-4, maybe a week long worth of good rains, you know, it'll swell it. But again, you're still going to have 2 months of at least forecast conditions of abnormal heat, below normal moisture. Even if it rained on it for a week right now and we walked away from it, you would have probably wouldn't see it for quite some time, but it's not going to go out. Again, with this 3-foot deep duff layers, that's going to hold heat for a long, long time. Yes?
When they burn the valley to find the outcroppings of ore, do the clocks start over then?
Depends on how much they burnt, but from that micro stem that was affected, yes. So to speak. I'm not sure what that looked like. And what you're saying, I just don't know what that looked like. I don't know if it completely took that stem out or not. I don't know that. What's that?
I think it took most of the mountain out of this side.
So when any kind of disturbance does that, when it takes those stems out, the clock starts over, yes.
And that's why on the copper mine side of Railroad Creek, when you high cut copper base of trail stuff, why the trees there are fairly small. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're talking 12-18 inch trees, you know. And so
you go up Martin Ridge, there's some great big ones.
So I think they burned that slope off, and they probably chose a time of year when they would have the outcome they wanted. And it wouldn't burn everything in the entire valley off.
So, I mean, humans and fire have had a long relationship in itself. In the Americas here, the American Indians used it to clear plantations, drive, you know, game out of certain areas, and they also used it for the same thing. They did manage the land to a certain extent with fire as well. So, I mean, it's not just nature necessarily, but humans as part of nature is sometimes part of the whole cycle. So that's what our strategy box looks like. What else about the fire or?
What are the endangered species that are in that part of the forest?
So what they're managing, so there's no endangered species that have been found in here through wildlife surveys, but it's actual habitat potential. And through the Endangered Species Act, we have to manage for habitat, even if there's not a species found in there. So it's suitable for spotted owl. So anybody that's familiar with the timber industry, you might call it a dirty word. But it doesn't matter, you know, from an agency standpoint, it doesn't matter, you know, if it's an actual law that you have to do this. So.
How many guys do you have on the ground now?
80, we have 4 crews plus the overhead supervision. So we're looking at a total of 93, I think, is here.
In Railroad Creek.
And then there's a whole another part of the fire incident management team that's managing things back at 25 miles. That's probably a staff of about 20. And that's a small team. So if this thing was to escalate and actually immediately threaten you guys, you would see probably a type 1 or a type 2 incident management team I bring a whole host, I mean, you guys wouldn't be here to see it, but there'd be a whole host of bodies and hotshot crews and helicopters. And
it's impressive.
The rooftops would be red and hold the village and, you know, yeah, retarded.
Matt, do you, are there any identified trigger points for Type 2 call for order of Type 2 team?
The Type 2 team would probably, it would depend on what happens when we light this. If that, if we have issues, control issues, it spots over into the old donkey fire, or if it gets established somewhere around here, if we have any kind of control issues, we would probably look at ramping up the incident management team.
And, you know, we talked about what we put the fire out of. If you have success and you're able to get good containment lines early this summer, we would still have a lot of smoke and burning from the center of this fire until the snow falls.
So I'll lead into that's good. I'll lead into that because that's true. There will still be a lot of residual smoke for days, for weeks, really. That'll be settling down in the valley in the mornings and the evenings. We're not going to be able to go in here for the same reason. We're not going to go in there to fight the fire. We're not going to have. We're not going to go in there to actually mop all this stuff up for the same reasons. However, along the road here, any kind of fire we put down in here, we're going to be mopping it up almost immediately after it's done consuming. For two reasons: for cut down on the smoke for the traffic along the road, and we also don't want to have any kind of soil issues in here.
When you talk about mopping, does that include lots of water? Does that come out of the creek from down below?
So what we'll end up doing is we actually have some contracts set up with the home and mine equipment stuff, their water tenders. We're trying to actually tap into what they have available to incorporate this in, so we don't have to deal with the logistical issues of actually barging fire engines and pumps and things like that in. So we're going to use what we can from the mine, but we will also bring in, you know, probably have to bring in a few engines to do what we need to do here. So we'll be pulling out of Railroad Creek. The mine's pumps are going to support our water operations. And we'd also, you know, wherever we have water, we're going to pull water from to use for our needs.
When you look at the incident web on for this particular incident, and you look at the map online, there are portions of the map that are grayed out. Are those portions that have burned previously that don't have the same amount of fuel? Is that?
I'm trying to imagine. I haven't seen InstaWeb map that they have on there, but is it like this?
Yeah, it shows the far side of the lake, and it shows part of what it looks like a donkey fire. So I was just wondering if they grayed that to indicate that there's not as much fuel available.
In the current map that's being produced out of camp, there's a boundary line that does have some of that shading in there.
Yeah.
And what they're doing that is, the GIS guy probably shouldn't have that on there, the map I saw this morning that had it is representing the boundary for what's called a TFR, a temporary flight restriction. And what that does is it tells anybody in the air, pilots, any military, anybody that's around the area that we actually have aircraft assigned in this incident that might be operating into it in this area. So don't go inside that boundary. That's what it's talking about. what else? So anyways, so yes. Oh yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
go ahead.
So if the fire were to be satisfactorily contained within the next couple months, but before the snow falls, what sort of residual crew would be remaining to keep an eye on it?
Well, there will be, I'll just say the appropriate amount or number. Because it'll vary. I can't tell you. I mean, we don't have a set number. We're going to say we're going to keep this many bodies here. But we will keep the appropriate amount of bodies to deal with any kind of issues. I mean, this is going to be watched all season long, probably until we get that season ending event.
So is that... The people that are on the ground now, will they stay, or are they one part of them, and then some of these other skills comes?
Well, so the guys that are here now, typically firefighters, crews, and single, you know, single resource or single overhead people, we go on 14-day assignments outside of our districts or our homes. So every 14 days, they have to take 2 days off, and it usually means they go home, they reset, and then they get... Hotshot crews are a little bit different, okay? They're prioritized geographically and nationally. It's called a national resource. And just to make it clear, a hotshot crew is a 20-person crew. They're not smoke jumpers, they're not repellers. They're people, hand crew people on the ground. They're called hotshots because they have a larger skill set. They have the best skill set available to firefighters in the wildland realms. In qualifications of their personnel, of their capabilities to sustain themselves in rugged, remote terrain, and they just have that skill set, so they're considered a hotshot. We also have hand crews that aren't hotshots. We have two crews out there right now that are considered Type 2 IA crews, initial attack crews. That are not hotshot crews because they don't have the crew qualification structure that a hotshot crew would. A lot of it has to do with physical conditioning as well. And so, just want to make that differentiation.
Tough work.
It is tough work, no matter who you are. I'm sorry, the rest of your question was?
Just, you asked
me. Okay. So there will be new crews coming in after these guys time out. It's like the shift, the mine shifts. They're here for a certain amount of days. They go out. They bring new people in. Same kind of rotation. So we'll have more crews coming in to deal with whatever. You know, if this thing just sits there for another week or two or whatever, you might what's wrong with that. you're not going to see a whole lot of firefighters in here. You will see firefighters, just not a whole lot of us, if we're just in a monitoring mode. Okay. And there will be people with eyes on us daily, no matter what the conditions. The monitoring mode is, you know, monitoring to see when these conditions are met, or when they might be, trying to stay ahead of it, to bring in the right resources to do the job we need to do.
And do you monitor from the satellite, getting those views, or are there...
No, by physically monitoring. We have people looking at from boat docks. We have a helicopter, a recon helicopter. It's a smaller helicopter we use to get up and fly around it and look at it. So those things are occurring daily, and we'll continue to do so. Yes.
Could you just show us where Wolverine Creek actually is?
I think the yellow line is right on it.
Matt, how much line have they... how much containment line have they actually completed or road prep?
Okay. Our ending point is somewhere around mile 5. We're about 3/4 of the way in. So by tomorrow or the next day, we'll have that 5 miles along the road completed and this piece completed. We also, what we did is in the switchbacks, we had to straighten them out. And those fingers that happen along the switchbacks makes our control or our holding very difficult.
Sure.
So we have to align it with a straight line in alignment with the ridge to get the best holding feature. So we actually have hand line along the switchbacks from the top all the way down to this side of the dock.
Wow.
So that way we can cut out Lucerne also as an issue.
Is there anything that we could do to show your firefighters our appreciation?
I'll tell you this. We as firefighters have a culture of we don't have a hero mentality. And we typically will shy away from, you know, public exposure that way. Because we do this because we actually believe in what we're doing. You know, and there's actually reasons why we do this, and that's good enough, right? But, I mean, just a general thank you is good enough. I mean, we're not going to shy away from appreciation. But it doesn't have to be a parade or anything.
For the occasional ice cream?
Yeah.
For some ice cream.
If there's an evacuation, folks are going to be wondering when they can come back in. So is there some point where you know that it's okay for folks to come back? And if we're watching the news or looking at maps online, is there some indication that we can see that it's getting closer to time to come back in?
So that is a very hard one to say right here and now. Reason being is we don't know what the fire is going to look like when it comes through here. It's going to be based on the condition of the road, really. In the worst case scenario, if this gets a high severity burn, either because it runs through here, or you know the fuel conditions are just you know, it burns hot. Worst case scenario is that there will be another team after the fire team called a BEAR team, Burn Area Emergency Rehabilitation Team. So those guys come in to do emergency soil stabilization projects that would further keep that road closed until it's safe to travel. Does that make sense? So it just depends. I don't have a good answer for that. I would say under ideal conditions, this gets burned off, you know, 5 to 7 days, we do our mop-up, and that road is probably secure.
Inside 2 weeks.
What's that?
Inside of 2 weeks, basically.
In the ideal situation, yes. The other part of that would be, you know, I think that's probably the ideal situation, and the worst case situation could be months. I mean, if it's really that bad, if it gets really bad, then they may shut it down throughout the rest of the year to give it time to get those rehabilitation projects in place and the soil stabilized. That'll be a risk tolerance decision at our agency administrator level, either a district ranger or a forest supervisor. We'll make a call. If anybody knows anything about what's going on at Kinnear Valley from the fires last year, they're dealing with kind of the same situation. They closed off a section of that to the public based because they thought there was health hazards and risks there. And it's still closed right now, so it's been almost a full year.
Even the people who live there.
People that live there, they're the forest boundary is what's closed. The forest road systems are closed.
Thank you.
But I presume that they basically
did you get that, Mark? Our Wolverine operations is trying to get a hold of you.
I presume we would be evacuated before you would be
That's right. Unless it was a true emergency, we would not put fire on this ridge while you guys are still here.
Canada? He's on hold later.
He was on hold.
Yeah.
So, we would give you guys advance notice as much as possible for the evacuation to occur. We would then do our firing operation, hopefully when everybody's out, because we don't want to have to trap anybody in here. Yeah.
So at what point would it take for us to go from a level 2 back down to a level 1 again?
I don't think it's going to go back to a level 1 until this thing's out.
Yeah.
Let us know.
So with all this lightning going on right now, thunder, what is the Forest Service doing in terms of monitoring all that stuff going on?
We have lightning maps, number one. So we know we can take a look at a map, and it's accurate within 2 hours, I believe. So you can pull up a map. And don't tell me about the science. I don't know. It's kind of weird how they can do this, right? But they know where lightning strikes, so we can take a look at that map and see, like, oh, there's lightning strikes here, 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 and here. And how many? You can do that through a course in a period of 24 to 48 hours. So that way, that's one technology. The other technology is if we have any lookouts up, or Forest Service lookouts, they report smoke, fires. And so that's our detection methods. And obviously, public plays a big role in that.
I didn't know about lightning maps.
Yeah. Technology, right?
Wow, that's amazing.
Like, for this incident here, we saw this on our lightning maps, this and three other lightning strikes. Four of them up here, that last little thing that happened.
This Wolverine Creek when you saw on a lightning map.
Yeah. That's why we know it was lightning, and obviously, I don't know who would be up there. But it's funny because, not funny, but it was interesting that each of those lightning strikes caused an actual fire. Every time a lightning strike doesn't mean that there's actual fire, it's caused. But they had a 100% batting average that did. The park had two fires, and then we had the two fires, Lightning Ridge and Golden. So let me tell this into real quick into a little bit more as my closing discussion is. Is fire altogether a bad thing?
No.
No.
Anybody ever heard of serotonin cones?
Yeah.
What's a species?
When the there's fire.
Lodgepole is a great example. What else?
Wolverine or Marines.
Well, I'll tell you this. There was a problem in the Sequoia National Park and the Sequoia forest ecosystem for about 50, 75 years. They couldn't figure out why it wasn't repopulating. It's because fire suppression within the park was so intense that it never gave fire a chance to go through there. Once they figured out that actually you need fire to open up those serotonin cones for it to repopulate, it can happen. So, anyways, fire, you know, it's kind of scary to people that are threatened to it, for sure. And there's legitimate issues with... There's legitimate infrastructure and social and economic issues that are integrated with our decisions to suppress fire. Can you guys figure out who or
what? Who what?
They're saying somebody.
I think that was one of the crews.
Yeah. Okay. Anyways, just to conclude the discussion. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say, with that purple color line, then what you're basically saying is that it's not if, but when.
That's right.
That is reached, there will be need for leaving this area.
Our best experience, our best fire history says that it's an if, not, or it's a when, not an if.
But you still at all.
That's a fairly big window from what we days to 2 weeks.
Yeah, you get a shot of rain like this, it's going to keep it in that little area where it's at for a little bit.
So time is what's adjusting.
Very ambiguous. So we can sit here with this thing looming for weeks, maybe a month, or it may just go out altogether. You know, I mean, but that's an odd, or that's not a realistic thought process.
Well, we have power over El Nino, and we're working on it.
Are there any more questions for Matt? Well, we want to just thank you for coming. You'll see Matt around here on and off.
Yep.
You said a long time, didn't you? For a while. So, nice to Matt. And we're just so grateful. Excellent.
And really, every time you see me, anybody has questions or wants to talk or about, you know, whatever, just let me know. I'm fairly open and I'm very transparent, and the agency, the district in itself, is we want to be transparent with you guys. You know, if there's a delay in getting information out there, it's only probably because we want to be consistent and maybe we don't know the answers ourselves, so we don't want to just shoot from the hip and give an off message to the mass population.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Matt.